What amount of time would you like to reserve, if any, for rebuttal?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. All right. You have it, and you may proceed when you're ready.
All right, please. Mr. Tuteberry cites a case on page 8 of his brief that says contracts must be considered as a whole without giving emphasis to isolated terms. And then he argues in his brief that the first sentence of the operative paragraph that brings us here in this breach of contract case should be read separately from the other sentences. He says that there is no conditions precedent to Mrs. Hartman being required to pay 30% of college education. And I would suggest, if you want to please, if you read that paragraph, undergraduate education, which is what brings us here, what the parties agreed to is she would pay 30%, the dad would pay 70%. The parties would select, not the children, but the parties would select the college that the children would go to. It says the college shall be selected by the parties in timely consultation with each other. And it said the parties shall consider preferences, qualifications, and abilities of each child concerned and the financial resources available. Mr. Hogg was asked a request for admission that the parties never consulted with each other prior to Oakley and Delaney Hogg attended East Carolina University. And his answer was, admit as the children picked where they wanted to apply and attend. Ms. Hartman didn't contract for that to be the case.
Let me interrupt you, counsel, because, you know, contract law, you get into the terms of the contract here require, as you correctly point out, selection by the parties, but after consultation with the child, essentially. The child has selected East Carolina University, and the parents presumably need to ratify that. Would you agree? Under the terms of the contract?
I would argue that the contract said that the parties, the college would be selected by the parties in timely consultation with each other. It didn't say anything.
The parties shall consider the preferences, qualifications, ability of each child, and financial resources of
Yes, sir. But the first, the preceding paragraph, it's the parties that are going to select the college, not the children. And his request.
Your client, though, eventually learned of the ECU selection and the daughter's admission, indicated she didn't object to it, made some payments, and I think she was basically, I guess the argument is whether by her conduct she was ratifying the choice that was made. And if that's the case, how is the trial court in error?
Well, first of all, I think part of what Your Honor just suggested is what Mr. Whitmire argued to the court that was not what the evidence is. Mr. Whitmire argued to the court that it's clear from the evidence that the preconditions never occurred because Mrs. Hartman refused to talk to her two daughters and her ex-husband. That was what Mr. Whitmire argued. And he argued her testimony is that she elected not to consider it. She elected not to participate. She sat on her rights. And I asked the trial court at that point, let me get a transcript because I don't believe that's the evidence. And I think if you read all of this transcript, the children just announced to her where they were going to school. She found out about it on Facebook. There was nothing for her.
Getting to Judge Humphrey's question, did her actions in effect assent to that determination? Because she did pay towards some of the college, didn't she?
Well, she did pay, and Mr. Tuteberry argues that that's a waiver, Judge, and he cites a case that I think is totally different from this, but I don't believe that the fact that a mother voluntarily pays a tuition for her college, for children who are in college, voluntarily pays it, means that she's acquiescing to something that had already been determined, and she didn't get the benefit of her bargain.
Let's take a look at just true contractual principles, and four people can look at a contract and interpret it four different ways. That's the nature of contracts.
That's why we come here.
That's why you come here. And so one interpretation of the contract could be the way that your opponent colleague interprets it. Judge Humphrey interpreted it one way, I can interpret it one way. But what is critical, in making those interpretations is what do the parties do in reliance to what are reasonable interpretations of that contract. And so what I believe I'm going to hear from the other side is that her payment toward that college is more consistent with his interpretation, his client's interpretation, than what you're suggesting your client's actions should be interpreted as.
Well, that might be the case, but I don't know that it's a case of interpretation. It's a case of her paying for her children's education. She gets finds out on Facebook that they're going to East Carolina University. The testimony was Mr. Hogg never consulted with her about it. There was never any discussion about financial resources available.
The evidence that was there was a discussion over dinner in front of her, and she didn't object.
Well, Fiona, please, that was after the fact. That was after she had already been accepted, and she's announced, I'm going to East Carolina. I mean, I guess the mother could have jumped up and down and said, well, that isn't where I wanted you to go. I never agreed to pay part of that. I mean, not objecting doesn't mean she's waiving her rights.
But you said before it was after she applied. Well, I assume they had to apply to see if they could even get in before you could make a decision.
I think dinner conversation occurred after she was in.
Well, it seems to be
she'd been accepted, and it just announced that she was going.
It seems to be a fair reading of the agreement is that the parties are agreeing that in order to require payment by the parties for the children's tuition, they have to select the college, or at least, you know, be involved collectively in the process of selecting the college the children are going to attend. Now, clearly that wasn't done in the way the agreement specifically specified. But if after the fact the parties, in effect, ratify the choice, then it seems to me any contractual cause of action is out the window. I mean, applying pure contract law.
Judge Humphreys, I would just suggest if we read this full transcript, if ratifying means that she's at dinner with the children, and they say, I'm going to East Carolina, and she doesn't object to it, and that ratifies it. I just don't think...
Well, she doesn't say when she learns the child is... You know, the child can go... theoretically, under this agreement, the children can go to any colleges they want to. The question is, who's going to pay for the education?
That's right.
So here, if the mother is going to be expected to pay for part of the education, she has to have... you know, a say in where the children are going to go to school. And here, the child elects to go to ECU, and or the children, I should say, elect to go to ECU, and the mother then, after the fact, elects to help pay for that. The trial court concluded, at least implicitly, that if not the factor, it was a factor in concluding that the mother had agreed after the fact, not before the fact, but after the fact, with the child's choice of educational institution, thus satisfying the agreement. So I'm still trying to understand where the trial court erred.
That's not what the trial court said. The trial court said her testimony is that she elected not to consider it. She elected not to participate. She sat on her rights. That's when I asked the court, let me get a transcript, because that's not the evidence. That's what the trial court said when it made its finding.
But couldn't that reasonably be interpreted? And this is the problem that appellate courts have, is we're trying to figure out what trial courts did. Could it be interpreted that the trial court's statement that she sat on her rights relate to the fact that when the child made everybody aware that she wanted to go to a specific college and mother didn't say anything about it, that's when she sat on her rights?
I would argue that she maybe sat on her rights as a parent in not making a scene about it and voluntarily making payments to pay for her own child's education. I would argue she did not sit on any rights from the standpoint of what the law is, because the deal had already been done. There were two conditions precedent to her having to pay, and neither of those conditions were ever met.
Well, one fact that you haven't mentioned is that at least it's arguably in support of the ratification theory, is that when asked why she had not paid the tuition for the next year, her response was not, I have no legal obligation to do so because you didn't follow the agreement. Her response was, I've not been able to, suggesting that she just didn't have the financial means to. So, you know, it seems to me that, that there's certainly some evidence from which a court can conclude that after the fact, at least, she was in full agreement with the children's choice of college.
Well,
and if that's the case, what's the problem?
I still don't think in doing that, did she incur then legal obligations to pay for college wherever they wanted to go. Her legal obligations arise from this contract, and there were two conditions precedent they were never met. The fact that she, as I told Judge Alston, doesn't get upset at the dinner table and doesn't say, I'm not going to pay or whatnot, she voluntarily pays. It still doesn't eliminate the contractual aspect of the case, which should not require any interpretation. The contract is very clear that there were two conditions precedent that were never met.
Mr. Blackman, I should let you know you're going into your rebuttal.
Okay. I'm sorry. Thank you.
You may continue or reserve. Mr. Tittimeri? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Judge.
Before you jump into the merits, let's talk about like a better way of putting it, the default argument that you make, that these arguments were not set forth in the brief and authorities weren't cited, et cetera.
Yes, sir. So I can take the assignments of error in reverse order then.
Yes, sir.
So Mr. Blackburn in number four essentially never argues anything other than the exhibit should have been admitted. And the exhibit that he's referencing in this colored exhibit is this one, and I don't know if yours is in color or not, but this was a settlement statement that was provided to Ms. Hartman at a mediation and essentially lays out three different options of I'm willing to do this, I'm willing to do this, I'm willing to do this, and she ultimately picked one. And if you compare this to the property settlement agreement between the parties, she picks the top one. And it's because presumably she gets more cash that way, because the property settlement agreement equalizes the cash payout to her, the difference between $383.15 and $182,000. She then gets that cash, and the properties that are not held in reserve for the children's education. And so the only argument that's made on assignment of error number four is that this exhibit should have been admitted. And, of course, this was a settlement negotiation between the parties years before they ever got to court on a show cause, and thus not properly sustaining the objection would have been proper for the trial court, because years later he shouldn't be considering settlement negotiations between the parties on a show cause, quite simply.
So your default argument only relates to issue four.
And also to number three, Judge, the and I'll pull it up. Judge, assignment of error number three is about the transcript and about whether or not the court should have ordered the transcript. And I essentially argue there that, he notes in the assignment of error that it's that the mother elected not to consider the preferences, qualifications, and abilities, and that the court erred in finding that, as Judge Humphreys has already pointed out. I think there is evidence for that, but he doesn't really even argue that in his brief. He really essentially argues that the trial court should have been required, I guess, to order the transcript. And as I note in there, I think the hearing was just about an hour long, and he ruled on that occasion. He didn't write a letter opinion later. And so, you know, I've been sitting here all day long, and I would imagine that the three of you, if this was an hour evidentiary hearing, would remember what you've heard in the past hour. And when you rule on the spot like that, I don't know of any authority nor any legitimate reason for that judge to order then the transcript. There's certainly no legal requirement that I'm aware of that the court is required to order the transcript and then review it. And as Judge Humphreys has already pointed out, I think the evidence is there, you know, that his ruling is accurate anyway. So,
okay. Switching to the merits as argued by your opponent, colleague. It appears that the dispute on appeal is what are the circumstances that give effect to the effectuation of this contract.
Yes, sir.
Whether or not the mother's involvement in the determination of where this child, these children go to school, is essentially a condition preceded to the determinations of whether or not she should pay or not. Your opponent colleagues envisioning that mother, father, sit down with child and say, okay, let's all come to a conclusion as to where you're going to go to school. And once that consensus is reached one way or another, then that's where the obligation to pay arises. Obviously, no one can illegally withhold their consent to a reasonable choice. I guess that would be the basis of his argument. Since mother sort of found out about this thing after the fact, how was that condition preceded not satisfied?
So some of what he was referring to was not my recollection of the transcript, and I read this again this morning, and I put all these notes on here for this reason. And so on, they were actually at the dinner table when she was accepted. That's on page 13 of the transcript. This was not after the fact. Again, as the court's pointed out, she has to be accepted before the parents can decide where she goes. I wish as a parent that I could just decide to send my kids to school before they were accepted there, but they have to be accepted first. And, you know, he also argues that that she found it on Facebook, but the evidence has to be taken in the light most favorable to Mr. Hogg at this point, which is that she found out at the kitchen table the same time he found out that the child had been accepted to ECU. That's not after the fact. That would be the moment that they could even decide to send her there, and this was the younger child, Delaney. And so I'm not sure that she did find out after the fact, and I think the trial court's point in reviewing the transcript is very specifically that in response to Mr. Whitmire's questions, she spoke to no one. The questions posed to her were, did anyone refuse to speak to you? Did your children refuse to speak to you? Did your husband, your ex-husband refuse to speak to you about this? And her only response was sort of elusive. I don't think she really wanted to answer the question, if you want my honest opinion about it. Her answer was, there was no discussion. Well, there was no discussion because there's no evidence that she ever tried to have a discussion with anyone.
So this having lasagna at the kitchen table was when it was discovered that the child was accepted to East Carolina.
Yeah, and Judge, that's exactly what
they had decided to go necessarily.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, she couldn't decide to go there before she gets accepted. I mean, maybe.
Or it wasn't like, I've just been accepted and that's where I'm going.
That's not what the evidence was on page 13.
Basically, what you're suggesting is that this was the child's choice, and once the child's choice was made, there had to be other circumstances or implementation of the child's choice, and that's when mom's involvement should have occurred.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the child has to apply and be accepted before the parents can even have a discussion about whether she's really going to go there and whether they're going to be legally obligated to pay for it. I can't imagine that these two folks would sit at the kitchen table and say, well, let's decide that Delaney's going to go to UVA when Delaney hasn't applied to UVA or been accepted to UVA. That would be sort of an absurd result to expect those two folks to do that. So I just don't think that's reasonable. The whole Facebook thing, again, I don't think is before this court because those are facts that were disputed by Mr. Hogg at the trial level, and you're required, obviously, to review factual findings in the light most favorable to him. So I think that's really what the trial court was talking about. And then again, as Judge Humphreys has pointed out, she's, and the first two assignments of error are really the same thing, in my opinion. It's whether she waived or didn't waive. And so I just don't know how she gets around the fact that she paid for this. I find it interesting that Mr. Blackburn argues today that she was voluntarily making payments because the evidence in the trial level was that she paid 30% of the tuition, which just so happens to be the exact amount that's set forth in the party's property settlement agreement. And so this is not like she paid 10% or 15% or 60%. She just happened to follow exactly the contract that the parties had entered into. And that is evidence that's in the record before this court. And so, even if the court does find that these were conditions precedent, which they very well may be, her actions after the fact certainly ratified that, as the court has already made reference to. I just don't know how you get around that. And obviously, that since this happened, time has continued to pass. There have been two more semesters since then. I understand that evidence is not before this court. So you're stuck with just a very limited amount of time, really two semesters. One semester for Delaney, she pays it. I think including a computer payment off the top of my head. She pays exactly 30% of the tuition, also buys a computer, and then the following semester refuses to pay. I'm happy to answer any other questions the court has, but I think it's relatively straightforward. She certainly has waived, from what I review, and the trial court was well within the evidence to find her in contempt.
What exactly has she waived? It seems to me there's a legal distinction between waiving your right to enforce a contract and ratifying its terms after the fact.
So, Judge, I think what she's waived is the right to rely on the language of the property settlement agreement, where it says she gets to select the college in consultation with him before she's then required to legally pay for the expenses. If you essentially give up that right by then following the contract through your actions, essentially waiver by action, if, you know, the children select ECU, you were, let's assume for the sake of argument, never consulted, you never talked to your ex-husband at all about the financial resources or anything at all, which is basically what happened in this case. Let's say she even tried to do that for the sake of argument. If she then goes on and follows the contract, which is what she did, and pays 30% of the tuition and pays for the computer, then she is now waiving her right to use that language of the contract as a defense and a show cause. I don't think she can come back later and say, well, we didn't talk about this and all that, and I know I paid for it, but that doesn't matter that I paid for it. It doesn't matter that we actually begun to execute the contract for multiple reasons. One, she actually did it, and so I think she's waived her ability. But two, Mr. Hogg has also relied on this, and the evidence was he paid the other 70%.
Yeah, but so, waiver is a more difficult hurdle for you to overcome than ratification, I think.
Well, and it's, but I guess really her actions are both. I mean, her action of paying is ratification, but it is also the action that is required for waiver, in my opinion. It is the same exact action that applies in both legal circumstances.
It's the same factual underpinning, but the standard is different.
Yes, sir. Right. The same factual circumstance applies to two different legal analyses.
Okay.
Any further questions?
All right. Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Blackburn, you have your rebuttal time.
Just very briefly, if you want, please.
The request for admission was admitted the parties never consulted with each other, and it was admitted as the children picked where they wanted to apply and attend. You know, there was no testimony from Mr. Hogg that, hey, I called Patty up. I tried to talk to her about where we wanted to send our kids to school. I wanted to sit down and talk with her about the financial resources that were available, that the contract said. There was no testimony that he did anything. And this old case that Mr. Tedbury cited in his brief, it's a Grattan case. In that case that he cited, it says, there are cases in which performance of a condition precedent may be dispensed with. When the party seeking enforcement of the contract, that's Mr. Hall, has done everything that could be done on his part to carry it into effect. There's no evidence here that he did anything to ever sit down with her and say, hey, you know, the girls are getting ready to go to college. We need to sit down and talk about where they're going to go, like our contract says, and talk about where we're going to get the money. That was never done. And then he admits in a request for admission, the children pick where they wanted to apply and attend. I would just again argue that condition precedent has never been met. As to the exhibit, he referred to the color-coded exhibit. It's on page 100 in the appendix. In that exhibit was refused. My argument in getting it in was, when the contract says that the parties will consider the financial resources, I think that's somewhat ambiguous as to what financial resources are they talking about. And when they went to mediation, this exhibit was brought by Mr. Hogg to mediation, and he's incorrect. He says she picked the top scenario where she got more property. That's not true. In the top scenario, she got the identical two pieces of property that she got in the bottom two scenarios. She didn't get anything else. But if you look in the bottom two scenarios, look at the bottom one, for example. He owns two parcels, Shire Parkway and Edgewood Drive, that has $182,000 in equity in those two. And he labels them Kids College Fund. And I ask him in the hearing, have you sold either one of those? And he says no. So he comes to mediation and portrays this as we use this for their college education, and then he doesn't do it. So I think he had a burden. If he's the one that wants to dispense with the condition precedent, he had a burden to do everything he could do to see that the condition precedent was carried out, and he didn't do anything on it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Blackwood.
Thank you.
We will greet counsel, and then the next case in our docket is Tobias Dayton McLean versus Commonwealth.